Keep Talking exists to have conversations that might help to make a better society and a better culture. I believe that each guest has important information and stories to make public. This is the Keep Talking podcast. To support it, please take a second and subscribe to the show. It helps to make this content possible. I want to give the listeners today a picture of what America was like in relation to animals at the kind of middle of the 19th century. You can take that question however you would like, but I'd love to inform the audience a little bit about what led to the beginning of the embers of this movement and how Americans really used to think about and treat animals back in roughly 1865, 1866.
Yeah. So, you know, I think in some ways, the most remarkable thing that you have to imagine when you cast your mind back to that period, even in, and especially in living in a city, is just how many animals there are all around you. You know, first of all, it's like you just have to begin with horses, which were, you know, the instruments of kind of every industry. You know, it's you know, horses before the Industrial Revolution, of course, horses are all you have to carry things around. And then paradoxically, with the Industrial Revolution, even with the rise of trains and streetcars and that sort of thing, the horses are still the engine. You know, they have to carry the coal to run the steam trains, and the steam trains, of course, can't carry you within the city. And so the trains in turn create all, much more commerce. And so the horses are moving, you know, they're pulling carts with livestock in them. They are, and they're individual modes of transit. You have wealthy people with carriages, you have, you know, working people who are using horses. So you just have to imagine horses everywhere. And then just all the other teeming animals of sort of city life. You do have food animals being transported through the city. You have slaughterhouses in the city. You have just, you know, random pigs, you know, rooting in trash and that sort of thing. You know, people keeping small amounts of livestock, even though they don't necessarily have dedicated outdoor spaces. And of course, when you think about dogs and cats, you do have some owned dogs, but it's much looser in that time period. The dogs aren't inside all the time. You have stray dogs everywhere. This is before spay and neuter. It's before rabies vaccination. So the dogs are not just everywhere, but they're also can be potentially threatening and even deadly. And, you know, so the world that the reformers sort of look at when they realize that something has to change in how humans are treating animals is one where the cruelty that they're seeing is just all around them. You know, you're walking around and you're seeing, you know, a guy's horse isn't pulling the load quickly enough. And so he's, you know, beating it to try to get it to go faster. You hear the sounds of the slaughterhouse, you know, you see the way that food animals are being treated. And so there's this real sense of, you know, our own communities need to be healed of the cruelty that we're seeing.
Yeah. And I would love to double down on that a little bit and give people who are watching this and listening to this, an insight into the cruelty that was exhibited towards animals back then. Obviously, I want to get to modern times later in the conversation, but you just told some story about horses, but you go into detail in the book about many other forms of cruelty towards animal, dog fighting, etc. I'd love to give you some more space to just paint the picture of what an average person. I know a lot of the books is kind of focused about New York City, within New York City, but what people would witness as a commonplace experience in life in the city.
Yeah, I mean, sure. I'm happy to talk about that. I will just say, you know, because I want people to read the book that that, you know, there are some passages that are hard to read, and some of what I'm about to describe falls into that category. But the whole book isn't like this. But yeah, I mean, look. So you mentioned dog fighting. This was a common you know, a form of entertainment that the people of all social classes would enjoy. And there were these rings where the dogs would fight each other to the death. More common than those is, you know, they would set rats loose and the dogs would sort of kill as many rats as possible within a certain time period. So you really did have blood sports that were happening in the city at this time, not necessarily out in the open, but everybody knew where you could go to see this, and it was seen as you know, socially acceptable to do that. To elaborate some about the food animals, you'd often see animals that were kind of tied together and like on their side in a stack, almost like they were wood or something. You know, there was, people just were willing to think about animals as kind of more like objects sometimes, in a way that was very disturbing. One of the things that the book does get into is the city pounds and the way that they would treat dogs. You know, every day at a certain time period, the New York City pound in this era would just kill all the dogs, and they would do it through drowning, you know, and it was very disturbing. I'm trying to think of more examples. I mean, the treatment of the horses was really the thing that galvanized Henry Burke, who founded the ASPCA. But you know, he also, you know, another subject of controversy that's still controversial is you had the beginnings of medical research on animals during this time period. And so there were in the physiology labs at Bellevue and the College of Physicians and Surgeons, you know, you would have people doing demonstrations of, you know, oh, well, this part of the brain does this, and we can tell that by, you know, severing this in a live rabbit and showing how it has this effect, which was very horrifying to the activists of the day. We have definitely, you know, it was a world where you would not just see animals, but there was just like a lot of pretty rank cruelty happening all around you.
I want to talk about kind of the general philosophy about that people held towards animals at that time. And it's funny, there are characters in this book, William Wilberforce. I hadn't read that name since I had read a book by Adam Hochschild many years ago about, I think, titled Breaking the Chains, about the advent of the anti-slavery movement. But I would love to go into how people really thought about animals in this era of, you know, moments of extreme cruelty. And you talk a little bit in the book about the dominion that rooted in the Judeo-Christian belief, I believe, about how animals were kind of here for us to do as we pleased with. But there also seemed to be in the beginning of the movement, like with the anti-slavery movement, another counter narrative about how humans were religiously should be motivated to take care of our common animals. You mentioned Darwin in the book, which this is a little bit before, I think, the percolation of Darwin's ideas into American culture. But I'd love to talk to you about how people were thinking about what animals were really here for, what their origins were, anything you could do to kind of illuminate how people were generally looking at animals in general, I think would be very helpful.
Yeah, sure. So as you alluded to, you know, there are certain sacred books of certain traditions, you know, do have proclamations about kindness to animals and our duty to animals in them. But the Hebrew Bible, the Christian Bible, less the case. And meanwhile, you do have all this language about dominion, of the sense of that the animals are there for humans to do with as we see fit. In the narrative that we tell, and the sort of scholars that I've read on this subject, the thing that really changes this is the arrival of what they call romanticism in the spiritual sense, in the religious sense, which really manifested first and foremost in England. You know, and it's worth saying that all of these ideas sort of began more in England. You mentioned William Wilberforce, of course, who was an earlier figure involved in the fight against animal, well, first against slavery and then against animal cruelty in England, well before the movement came to the United States. But even before that, this sort of romantic turn in the pulpit really presented a God who cared about individual people and their suffering to a degree that was not as common in the centuries before that. And that, you know, that once you begin to think about suffering, about the suffering of an individual as, and the joys of an individual, but really, you know, the pain and suffering of an individual human as worthy of consideration. And once you also begin to assimilate some of the new scientific understanding that really does begin well before Darwin about the idea that, hey, you know, animals and humans, or certainly mammals and humans, well, they have the same, you know, basic physiological structure, you know, they're so similar in so many different ways. They must therefore suffer the same way that we do. And you begin to sort of see certain people beginning to make these connections. You see, you know, one of the sort of biggest books against animal cruelty was published in 1776 in England by a minister there. And his arguments begin to make their way into Parliament in the early 1800s. And you begin to see initial attempts to ban certain forms of animal cruelty there. And that culminates in the founding of what becomes the Royal SPCA, which is the very first animal welfare organization in the 1820s. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's sort of pulling back again, you know, it is, even though, you know, the Judeo-Christian tradition is not very well kind of predisposed to reverence towards animals, it does sort of begin to percolate among religious people first. And even coming to the U.S., where none of the leaders were heavily religious figures, you nevertheless see sort of very religious arguments kind of under the surface in kind of how they think about what they're doing, which is, of course, you know, very, very common in the 19th century across the board.
I'm glad you brought that up. And I had taken a note of the name of that book, Humphrey Primett, a man I had never heard of before, A Dissertation on the Duty of Mercy, I believe is the book that you're referencing, which seemed to be the first treatise on animal rights or animal suffering. And there are so many other characters in your book that I had never heard of before, and you bring to the surface, that I would love to give a little space for you to talk about. And maybe I'll just ask a basic question. You mentioned his name earlier. Who was Henry Berg?
Henry Berg, you know, was a child of great wealth. His father was a prominent shipbuilder in New York, and inherited a great deal of money when he was a young man, which allowed him to sort of travel. He tried his hand at writing plays. He was a diplomat in the Lincoln administration in Russia. And while he was stationed in St. Petersburg, he had an awakening to the cause of cruelty to animals. He saw a driver, you know, beating a horse, and he got out of his carriage and forced him to stop. And he realized that, you know, he had that the power of his stature, so to speak, you know, his physical stature. He was a tall man with a commanding presence, and he also had a great deal of money, that he would be able to use that to try to help animals. And so he comes back to the United States after the Civil War and sets about founding the ASPCA on essentially on the model of what had happened in London. He stopped off in London on his way back and learned from the then head of the RSPCA kind of how the organization was set up and the way that it carried out law enforcement and so on. And you know, Henry Berg is he's a real riddle. He was never a big pet owner. It's not clear he ever owned a pet. He had a carriage dog, which was, you know, you'd have a dog that would run alongside your carriage to sort of help protect the horses, you know, and from being run into by other carts or what have you. And he had a bit of a foul sort of perspective on humanity, which really became more bitter over time as he struggled for the organization to have as much of an influence on law and society as he wanted to. But he had a real flair for the dramatic, really knew how to get media attention for what the ASPCA did. And for quite some time, you sometimes see references to him, people saying that he was, the most famous man in New York. People knew his face, because his sort of long face with the mustache was constantly being rendered in editorial cartoons at the time as symbolic of the crusade of cruelty to animals. And it was sort of a novelty. A phrase that we use a lot in the book is a magazine profile of him said that he had brought a new kind of goodness to the United States. And that idea of hey, we were all going about our business, and then suddenly this guy comes and forces either grants us in a positive way or sort of forces us in a negative way to reckon with like a new kind of goodness, was a feeling that really associated itself with him. He was really the face of the movement, not just in New York but around the country. He sort of became the face of the movement during the 2 decades that he was doing it before he died.
You mentioned the SPCA, and I'd love to give a little space to have you talk about what the real objectives were of the ASPCA specifically. What do we know about what really they were after initially? What were they trying to accomplish?
Well, I mean, so it's important to know that there were some laws against animal cruelty on the books in the United States, but they were basically neglected, and they really just went unenforced, in part because police forces of the time just weren't really oriented towards enforcing them. The main thing that he did on the model of what had happened in London is that he passed a law, a New York state law in Albany, a new sort of tougher, more specific anti-cruelty law that empowered his new organization, the ASPCA, to actually enforce the law. And this was the model that happened all around the country. So these were not just advocacy organizations. These were essentially set up as almost adjuncts of law enforcement. And they hired agents who went out to the street and made arrests. And they would then take the people they arrested directly to judges to try to win convictions against them, as if they were themselves law enforcement. They effectively were law enforcement. So that was the most dramatic part of it, and the part that they immediately then sort of started enforcing the new law. He also intended to take and tried to take the fight to sort of all manner of people in other ways. So in addition to sending his agents to raid the dog fighters and to, look at the slaughterhouses and so on, he also sent agents into the physiology labs of the doctors. And then he couldn't quite arrest them the way he arrested people in the street. But he would then give speeches about how barbaric it was the way they were experimenting on animals and tried to advocate for laws about that, though without really any success. Similarly, one of the things we write a lot about in the book is his kind of frenemy relationship with P.T. Barnum, and the practice of animal exhibitions, then later in the time period, of course, circuses, and the ASPCA would send agents to observe demonstrations at P.T. Barnum's museum, or circus performances. And if they saw something that they thought looked like cruelty, then they would raise a stink and there would be a big fight about it. And the open letters would spill into the newspapers and so on. So he had a kind of wide ranging idea about that there were these classes of animal abusers out there, and he was going to go after all of them, had a remarkable amount of success, with the caveat being that it was all very much based on sort of, okay, what's going on within our community? And the thing that really changes over this time period, which maybe we can wait and get to later, is the fact that, like, meanwhile, with food animals in particular, you begin to have this centralized, the rise of the sort of industrialized meat production is sort of in the manner that we have today. That all really happens during this time period as well. And that really kind of scrambles the sort of moral sense and the kind of moral arguments that a lot of these reformers had, because they were very accustomed to arguing about and trying to enforce acts of cruelty that they could see or that people could see kind of in their own neighborhoods. But by the end of our time period that we write about, you have like a huge proportion of the meat that's being sold in America. The animals are being raised and sold and slaughtered all in these very centralized places, like, you know, Chicago's Union Stockyards, and then the meatpacking district that's right next to that. And it sort of creates, I mean, you know, the subtitle of the book is how Americans came to feel the way they do about animals. And the argument that we're sort of making there is that during this time period, you see the kind of whole complex of different attitudes that we have, you know, the love of our pets and the rise of pets as sort of members of the family, that happens during this time period. You have the conservation movement that has caused us to sort of feel pretty keenly about wildlife species, while also they sort of exist as a kind of abstraction, and it's hard for us to know exactly what, you know, to do about the threatening of wildlife species. And then you have this sort of the shunting off into this kind of shadow realm of food animals, where we don't really, we're encouraged not to think about them. We're encouraged to sort of enjoy the products that they give us, like without really thinking hard about what their lives are like. Anyway, that's sort of a diversion, but that's, in my mind, that's sort of, it does kind of fit together. And it's like the ASPCA did sort of accomplish what it set out to do, but meanwhile, there was the world sort of changed for animals in a way that I think was difficult for that era of animal reformers to totally get their minds around.
It's such an excellent point, and I have to, obviously, that the suffering of animals is just inevitably going to be more salient if you're witnessing it, if you're around it, and not so much if these people, these animals, as you mentioned, are invisible. I definitely want to get into that transition. I would love to also give a little time. You've mentioned two words that I would love to double down on: cruelty and suffering, and the legal power at the time that the SPCA had to enforce, you know, these anti-cruelty measures. What do we know about what, legally speaking, they had the right, the authority to actually enforce?
You know, it was sort of up for negotiation case by case. I mean, you know, the language of the law was pretty straightforward. I mean, it did have to do with, I don't know, it probably had to do with cruelty, it probably had to do with suffering. There was, I don't remember the actual language, but in practice, you know, you would take a defendant in front of a judge and say, well, you know, I witnessed him, you know, beating his horse. And I mean, so many of the cases really did involve working people beating horses, like it was, or overloading them. You know, that was so much the kind of the law enforcement emphasis, because it was something you would just see everywhere around you. On the sort of far side of the spectrum, one of the cases we write about is the famous turtle case, where, you know, Henry Berg becomes aware that there is a sea captain who's brought a load of green sea turtles from Florida and is selling them at Fulton Market. And the turtles have been immobilized by being sort of kept on their backs and cords sort of poked through their fins, sort of like wrapped around to sort of keep them from moving. And he, you know, very correctly looks at the situation and says, you know, this is a really abominable way to store these turtles. He wasn't saying, you know, it's not moral to kill and eat turtle meat, which was very, very common, a delicacy at the time. The issue really was these turtles were brought, you know, suffering greatly by being stored this way. And now they're being stored this way for sale. And this needs to stop. And so he hauls the captain before the judge. And this is just, people lose their minds because the law uses the word animal. And at that time, people didn't think about turtles as animals. They even though the taxonomist knew better, and there's a sort of funny thing where he appeals to, you know, Harvard's, you know, Louis Agassiz at Harvard, who is, you know, at that point, the most famous scientist in America, and says, hey, they say a turtle is a fish. And he's like, no, that's not true. And also sort of that, oh, it wouldn't hurt a turtle to be kept in this way. A turtle wouldn't suffer in that way. Can a turtle even feel pain or so on? Like there just was this sort of sense that a lot of these like quote unquote lower animals were so different that wow, could they really even feel anything at all? And he lost that case. And those kinds of cases generally often didn't go his way because of, you know, you had to ultimately convince a judge that this would be worth sort of convicting somebody of a crime for. And a lot of times these judges weren't, you know, they weren't especially expert in animal issues. It's all very improvisational. You know, and Berg was somebody who just sort of took the latitude that he was given by this law that he himself had written and passed, and then went out and used his agents to start prosecuting things. You know, one fascinating story from the book is that it's a little bit of a detour, but the movement to prosecute cases of cruelty to children actually grows out of the ASPCA. Not because Henry Berg believes that a child is an animal and therefore deserves to be covered under the law, but rather that he just, you know, uses his agents to go and rescue a child who's in a situation of cruelty and wins the case and is inspired to basically go have a new child protection law passed and to start a sort of sister organization to prosecute cases of cruelty to children. And that's, I mean, I think it was just the 150th anniversary of that case is this year. And so that spreads around the country. And interestingly, a number of the organizations do essentially simultaneously prosecute or investigate cases of child cruelty and animal cruelty. And the phrase Humane Society like winds up designating these mostly these dual purpose organizations that are trying to look out for both. Anyway, that's a far afield from where you started the question, but I think that's an interesting aspect of this story.
Fascinating. Another character you bring to light in the book, another person I had never heard of before, and this is a simple question, and I will butcher his name. Who was George Angle or Angel? I'm not quite sure how to pronounce that.
Pronounced like Angel, just with an extra L at the end.
Yeah.
So George Angle was the son of a Baptist preacher, was a lawyer, an anti-slavery lawyer in the Boston area, and always had a kind of fondness to animals. He wrote a provision in his will when he was in his 40s that stipulated that, you know, if there was any money left over, that it would go towards educating children about being kind to animals. And then when he hears about the founding of the ASPCA, he becomes inspired. And in 1868, after a particularly sort of the story of this really cruel horse race that had gone from Boston to Worcester, Both of the horses died because they were pulling these like massive loads, and this was the last straw for him. And so he essentially becomes the Henry Berg of Boston, and founds the Massachusetts Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals. And he's really, you know, he's in some ways the central figure of our book, in part because he lives a little bit longer than Berg does, and so kind of lives into the sort of last decade that we cover, going all the way up to almost the turn of the 20th century. And he also, his orientation is somewhat less around law enforcement and somewhat more around evangelism, education. His society starts a publication called Our Dumb Animals, you know, which sounds funny today, but really was trying to remind readers that animals can't advocate for themselves. And this is the organization that's going to do that. But this magazine is essentially, it's aimed at women and children. It's designed to be read, you know, around the hearth or the breakfast table, and find inspiration, for everybody to be kind to animals. He's really instrumental in the spread of the novel Black Beauty, which was published in England, but it never comes to the US, or really even takes off worldwide until he just starts. He finds out about it and decides that this is the novel that's going to do for the cause of cruelty to horses what Uncle Tom's Cabin had done for the anti-slavery movement in the 1850s. And so, you know, he prints tens of thousands of copies, and they, you know, they say the Uncle Tom's Cabin of the horse on the cover. And, you know, about 9 months in, he sold, you know, more copies than Uncle Tom's Cabin did in its first year. And it becomes one of the 19th century's best-selling books because of this kind of campaign of literary piracy that he engages in. So he's a really remarkable figure. And I think one of the reasons why I think we like him so much is that one of the themes that we really come back to a lot in the book is about kind of imagination, and the sense that to be spurred by the cause of kindness to animals is sort of inherently an act of imagination, because they can't speak for themselves. They can't advocate for themselves. You know, their families can't advocate for them. It involves sort of making a leap across species barrier where we don't really understand what it's like to be them, but we do just have to imagine what it would be like to suffer, like in the ways that they're forced to suffer, like through imagining, you know, what it would be like to suffer in that way ourselves. And it's really George Angel is the one who really most fully inhabits that insight, and the idea that it's really the moral imagination, the sort of human sense of imagination that can change fundamentally how we look at the world and our politics and what we think is right and wrong by imagining ourselves into somebody else's perspective. George Angel's the one who really understands like just how crucial and powerful that is. And he does sort of so many different things over the course of his long, you know, years as an animal activist that are trying to sort of trigger that moral sense in different ways, you know, through different forms of education and you know, literature and you know, imagination.
I want you to let me know if you think this is true, because you note in one section of the book that Henry Berg was not a vegetarian, and I'm curious your takeaway from especially these two men and the movements in general. That my reading of it is more that they're interested in reducing suffering than eliminating meat consumption in general. I'd love for you to speak to that, if you think that's correct, or what these men would have considered a success. You know, a lot of what you've been talking about today is just consciousness raising. You mentioned romanticism and increasing empathy and imagination for what it must be like to be these animals. I'd love for you to speak to that in any detail you would like.
Sure. I mean, no, I don't. To my knowledge, I'm not sure that any of the figures of the activist figures in our book were vegetarians. You know, there was a vegetarian movement at the time. It was pretty health focused. And frankly, like health focused in ways that I'm not even sure were entirely accurate. Like I'm not sure that ultimately that the diets that they were advocating for were really very healthy. And you're correct that they didn't, for whatever reason, it didn't seem, I don't know, socially acceptable or possible for them to be vegetarians. I think it was a very fringe thing at the time to be a vegetarian. And I also think that the scale of the cruelty and the suffering seemed so great that the idea that you could just get it to the point that they were treated, that the animals were treated sort of more conscientiously, you know, whether in transport or sort of the actual process of killing them or so on, you know, the gap between what they knew was possible to alleviate suffering in the killing and treatment and care and housing and transportation of animals and what was actually happening, like not just you heard about third hand, but you could see in front of your very eyes, was so vast that I think they fairly kind of thought that they were advocating for a more civil version of a system that did kill animals than one that didn't kill animals at all. And I think that the fact that now the situation is different, I think is in part just a reflection of how far we've come in the treatment of animals. So, you know, another interesting kind of culture, it's not like a culture clash, but it's like, you know, even in our own day, I think attitudes about euthanasia are evolving. And I think even in my lifetime, you know, the sense that, that for an animal that's unwanted or for an animal that's like, you know, that's suffering in a way that it seems like too much trouble to try to alleviate it, that it's perfectly humane to euthanize that animal. I think we're now evolving to a perspective where, you know, in part because I think we've had so much success in reducing, you know, stray animal populations and unwanted animal populations, and now shelters increasingly are really able to adopt out animals that maybe even 10 or 15 years ago would have been hard to find homes for. That the sort of the rise of the no kill shelter movement has people thinking, you know, some people are very hardcore, like, you know, we really shouldn't be euthanizing animals if there's any possible chance of them having a life, you know, to go on living in a decent way. But I think even people who don't go quite that far are much more see euthanasia as a last resort. But in this time period, of course, the population of strays is just explosive. You have the fear of rabies. And meanwhile, the treatment of the animals in the shelters and pounds is so barbaric that a very humane thing that they did in this time period, which I do think was extremely humane, was they really tried to understand, okay, what do humane ways of euthanizing animals look like? How can we create systems for animal shelters to do euthanasia? You know, sometimes even of lots of dogs on certain days when there's just no hope of finding homes for them. How do we do that in a way that's as humane as possible? That's definitely sort of another era where I think for a present day reader, certainly a present day like real animal lover, there can be a little bit of a disconnect of like, wait, the humane people are all like going all in on like euthanasia methods, which doesn't seem as jarring to me, maybe a function of my age, but I think can feel jarring today. And again, I think another sign of progress where I think we're at the point that we can begin to kind of ask like, hey, do we really need to be euthanizing so many animals? But I do think in their time period, euthanasia was seen as a real like important subject for animal advocates to be investing in.
You alluded to this earlier, and I would love to spend some time talking about the transition to, you know, kind of industrialized meat production, and how what seems to me in reading your book that, you know, the presence of animal cruelty and just the horses being everywhere in city life to now the meat that people consume on their for their dinners are coming from some faraway place that they have no direct experience with. Maybe it makes sense to just start with that transition historically of how that happened, where this, you know, I grew up in a family with golden retrievers, and there's a culture in the U.S., I think, of just loving and doting on pets and a reverence for animals. I read some literature in college about that raised, I think, my own consciousness about the suffering of animals. Some of it was Peter Singer's work, who I'm sure you're familiar with to some degree. And it really got me thinking and made me pause. And for close to 7 years, I was a vegetarian. I then became a pescatarian for another 5 years. I do eat a little meat now. I always liked the question, what will future generations look back like we look back at slavery and Jim Crow and think, you know, how could you tolerate this? And it's the invisibility of these factory farms, I think, probably plays a role in why it's not a greater part of the discussion. People don't want to think about it. People don't want to have their imaginations go there. But, you know, I know you're a journalist and you must really care about these subjects to spend so much time writing about the history and the figures that really raised our consciousness about you know, having empathy for animals. Maybe we could start just at that transition point of moving the production of meat from the cities to these more industrialized areas, and what you think that's done to the conversation around animal suffering and the objectives that the, you know, the ASPCA was really looking to achieve in American culture generally.
Yeah. So, and in some ways, like, one of the biggest arcs of the book is really about this subject, you know, which in another way is like the story of late 19th century America and, you know, the profusion of the railroads, incredible growth in population, the incredible growth in urbanization and, you know, the movement of the population to cities. And so, yeah, I mean, I think this process, the process really starts in, I think, you know, the 1840s and 1850s when, you know, the initial profusion of rail lines sort of makes it possible to begin to centralize certain aspects of the trade in meat animals. So, you know, locally to places like Cincinnati or Chicago, you would have people producing cows sort of out, you know, cows or pigs sort of out in, you know, the countryside. And then the buyers increasingly would be in the city. And so you would take your cows into the city and sell them to somebody who where eventually they would be butchered. So for a while, what happens is, okay, the cows are raised sort of near these Midwestern kind of hubs, and Chicago quickly emerging as the biggest of them. Then they're sold to buyers who ship them out to where they're going to be consumed. So, for example, to New York City, Chicago cows would come to New York City, where they would be slaughtered by New York butchers and sold to New York customers. But then the rise of refrigeration, both kind of refrigeration sort of buildings and then also the refrigeration of train cars, means that you can do meat packing. And so, you know, right next to the Union Stockyards in Chicago, you have the rise of what's called Packing Town. And that's where people like Philip Armour and Gustavus Swift create these sort of titanic businesses where they buy the cows, they buy the beef cattle, they put them straight into the slaughterhouses, they disassemble them, they turn them into meat, they pack the meat, and then they ship it all around the country. And they even have sales offices all around the country where you can go and buy the meat. And that all happens basically during the 30 years that we're writing about, from 1866 to 1896. And so as we've discussed, and as you just sort of alluded to, it really just transforms the relationship with these animals. I mean, if you have a local butcher who's slaughtering animals, you really have a sense for where, you know, where your meat is coming from, even if it wasn't, even if the cow wasn't raised nearby. But the moment at which the meat arrives sort of either in a tin or as, or wrapped as a piece of refrigerated meat that's been shipped, you know, as is still the case, right? That's been butchered, raised and butchered sort of who knows where, and then sort of shipped to buy just as this inert piece of meat in your, you know, from your grocer or what have you. The animal has just become so much more of an abstraction. And so, yeah, I think that, that transformation is just like really, really profound. You know, this idea of the distance between the animals that we benefit from and their actual physical existence. Like there's a great distance in miles, but there's also sort of a great conceptual distance. One of the things that we get into in the conclusion is that if you talk about stuff like milk, for example, there's even this other distance of kind of diffusion, right? You know, like you buy a coffee with, you know, foam in your latte, and how many cows created the molecules of milk that are in that foam, right? You know, it's the milk that you buy, it's mingling the output of who knows, like tens, hundreds of cows. And coming from a place that you don't know where it's coming from. And so that sort of that the moral ledger, so to speak, becomes kind of even more complex, to the point that I don't think we reasonably ask ourselves to carry out that calculation. And yet without carrying out that calculation, some of this sort of the work that goes into making these kinds of moral transformations happen is really hard to do. You know, so many of the great moral transformations of the last, you know, three centuries or four centuries have been some version of the golden rule, right? Like treat this other, you know, person, or as the case may be, animal, the way that you might want to be treated. It's kind of an act of imagination. And I do think that act becomes a lot harder to carry out when the suffering of the animal is displaced sort of so far away from you and sort of along so many different, you know, axes, like, you know, distance and time and you know, knowledge of conditions and so on.
I know we're getting close to the end of the conversation, and I would be remiss if I didn't ask you how this book has affected you. It's a book of history, but I have to imagine that part of this, I believe your wife is a veterinarian, if I read that correctly. What do you think, you know, for modern people who are reading this, I think they're going to be very interested in the history of the animal rights movement in the country and some of these historical figures that they've never heard of before. But in modern times, given that reality that you just articulated, where do you come down, roughly speaking, on what is a ethical, obviously reasonable people can disagree, but what the ethical approach would be to, you know, meat consumption and our modern treatment of animals, and where you think, probably most importantly, there should be a justified reason for modern activism to change our current circumstances.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think that food production is really the main one, you know, and you know, Monica and I are vegetarian. We're not quite vegan. But it's something that we've sort of thought a lot about. I think the main thing that it sort of changed my mind about is really this subject of the kind of populations of animals that are being heavily used by humanity but are very remote from us. A subject we haven't talked that much about is sort of ongoing questions around animal research, which you know, by and large, you know, I'm you know, just sort of have a knee-jerk kind of pro science, pro-medicine orientation. And, you know, the story of Louis Pasteur's creation of the rabies vaccine, which we actually wrote about in the first book that we wrote, which was a history of cultural history of rabies, and then write about again sort of through a different lens in this book, you know, involved very painful first research and then kind of routinized use of animals to create the rabies vaccine. But of course, that rabies vaccine saved the lives of, you know, thousands of humans and like literally millions of animals, in the sense that we are now able to avoid killing stray dogs who bite us in the street, because we know that they're vaccinated against the one thing that they carry that can really harm us. And so that said, I do think about animals in research as another example of this just vast group of animals that, like, we don't really spend much time thinking about how they're being used, about whether they're being used as responsibly as they need to be. You know, as there is ongoing research with primates and so on that's pretty hard to hear about and doesn't get heard about that much, because, you know, the labs that do it are understandably very, you know, concerned about animal rights activists, you know, sneaking in or that sort of thing. But I think those are the two realms where, not that I have a sort of new, like, more strident politics on, but I've just recognized that there are these giant groups of animals that are out there that we are responsible for kind of collectively, that we don't really think nearly enough about. And I do think that, I hope the book is at least a wake up call to kind of think about all the animals around us in a different way.
Yeah, I think that's a good place to stop. I love the fact that you spent so much time putting this book together and writing down all the history. I learned a ton just in researching for this conversation. And like you said, I hope it starts a new conversation in our culture about all of the subjects that we touched on today. So I really appreciate the conversation and for you giving me your time, Bill.
Great. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Keep Talking. If you're finding value in this podcast, please consider supporting the show via the links below on Venmo, PayPal, or Patreon. Your support helps to make these conversations possible.